We could talk to you for at least one more dispensation.
Wow.
Well.
That's the cold open.
I know.
But no one
Crown, I
knows how
keep
long that
doing
is,
this.
right? So that
Wow.
could be very short or very long.
Welcome to the Two Cities Podcast, a podcast about theology, culture, and discipleship. And this is episode 224. In this episode, we're talking about the rise and fall of dispensationalism with Dr. Daniel Hummel. Dr. Daniel Hummel is director of the Lumen Center and Upper House in Madison, Wisconsin, and a research fellow in the history department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as well as the host of the podcast called Upwards, and the author of the book that we're excited to talk about in this episode, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, How the Evangelical Battle Over the End Times Shaped a Nation, published by Erdmans. Team members on the episode from the two cities include Dr. Brandon Hurlburt, Dr. Sydney Tooth, and me, Dr. John Anthony Dunn. So, Sydney and Brandon, what did you think of this historical conversation about dispensationalism's influence on American culture?
I thought it was great to hear a lot about the history of dispensationalism and how it gained influence key figures, but also just as Dr. Hummel talks about the fall and what he means by that, I think is really helpful. The degradation, how the discourse has really changed, and I think that aspect of it was really helpful and insightful. So I really enjoyed that.
I think often when we talk about dispensationalism, we can come at it as either outsiders who are looking in on this very bizarre thing that starts in the 70s and 80s, and Hal Lindsey and, you know, John Hagee, blood moons, and, you know, all sorts of just very, very bizarre things. And it's very easy to critique, and it just seems very, like, nonsense. Or maybe, you know, like myself, coming at it from an insider, you know, this is what I grew up with. A lot of it made sense until, you know, at one point it didn't. A lot of the kind of other ways of reading is either from the inside or it's just trying to critique it and not really try to understand it. And I would really, really, really appreciate it about Dr. Hummel's this episode and his book, which I think is fantastic, is he takes a historian's approach, very different than a lot of books I've read on dispensationalism. And he really just traces not only, you know, how we got to this bizarre place that we are in now, but really seeing where it begins, how it changes and morphs, how technology is involved, how, you know, printing press, how other movements that are happening, the Civil War, you know, early 20th century, how this gets changed and developed over time, to then when we finally meet and encounter this dispensationalism of Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye and Left Behind, everything that we've kind of understand, we actually have categories to be able to assess it. And one of the powerful things he talks about and he writes in his book is that, you know, this later stage dispensationalism is really this fall, this kind of like broken down, you know, hollowed version of what dispensationalism was in the past. And I think Dr. Hummel does a brilliant job of just explaining and articulating how all of these moving pieces fit together, and even offers at the very end, you know, a way forward. And I think that's very helpful for us and our listeners.
And if you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. You can also follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at our website at thetwocities.com. And with that, here's our conversation with Dr. Daniel Hummel. Well, Dr. Hummel, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
So we're really excited to talk about your book, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism. I think a great place to start, of course, is to hear, you know, what's the thesis of the book. But I think for a lot of people, it might be good just to know, what even is dispensationalism?
Yeah, and that's obviously a huge question. I think maybe to start with what it isn't, what I wanted to get across is it's not just an end times theology, which is often how it's known outside of, you know, sort of informed theological circles. People know dispensationalism because of the teaching of the rapture, the any moment rapture, I should say, the idea that at any moment true believers will get whisked up into heaven and will set off a scenario of end times prophecy fulfillment. That's what most people know it as, and that's a really important part of what dispensationalism is. But it's much more than that. It touches on all parts of theology, you could say, that that any tradition of theology would. And I think the key parts in addition to the eschatology is that there's a pretty distinct biblical hermeneutic that dispensationalists deploy, and it's using their own words, it's a plain or literal hermeneutic, which is a reading of scripture that's attempting to basically flatten it or read it all as you know, sort of clear propositional truth that can be extracted and then systematized into a theology. And in the 20th century in particular, this became very popular among evangelicals and fundamentalists in the United States, a plain or literal reading seen as the most authentic or the reading that would raise the Bible's authority to the highest possible level. So it's often associated with biblical inerrancy as well, and dispensationalists have been some of the staunchest defenders of biblical inerrancy as a proposition. There's also an interesting ecclesiology, you could say, to dispensationalism. And this comes to maybe what is the most important contribution that dispensationalists give, which is a church-Israel distinction. This distinction between the Jewish people and Israel as a sort of chosen people of God, and then a second chosen people of God, which is the church. And so most dispensationalists believe in two chosen peoples that coexist and that have their separate roles to play, but are still have those roles. So many Christians would see the church taking up the role that Israel played in the Old Testament, though there's a lot of nuances there, but essentially that God is working through the church today to redeem the world. And dispensationalists disagree with that, and they insist that God still has a very important role to play for Israel in the redemption of the world, and that the church has its own role to play. Going back in time to the 19th century, this would be very starkly contrasted between an earthly and a heavenly role, and that Israel would play the earthly role and that the church would play the heavenly role. Later dispensationalists sort of smooth that over a little and still talk about distinctive roles. And really the takeaway for that is that dispensationalists have a distinctive role for national Israel that will continue into the future. And that makes their interest in the current nation of Israel distinct or unique. Also their interest in Jews and Jewish evangelism as unique as well. So these are three of the key teachings that still dispensationalists today hold that would set them apart from other Protestants and indeed most other Christians.
Yeah, and your book is called The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism. So what is the rise of dispensationalism? How did these ideas spread?
Yeah, so, you know, it gets back to a figure that is plays an outside role, you could say, in Protestant history. That's John Nelson Darby. He founded the Exclusive Brethren or the Plymouth Brethren movement in the 1830s and 1840s. And the rise is really looking at how this Anglo-Irish elite figure in a sort of far-flung dissenter circle in the United Kingdom came to have an influence over a broad swath of American Protestantism. And it's a story that is part intellectual. It's about these ideas that Darby developed around the rapture, around this unique role of the church in Israel, and how those sort of infiltrated different American networks. But it's also a story about American Christianity and the way that a certain type of revivalism and openness to apocalypticism emerged in the second half of the 19th century. And these things came together in people like Dwight Moody, who was a very significant revivalist in the late 19th century, who adopted some of these teachings and was also probably the most well-known American in the 1880s and 1890s. And he, you know, sort of made the rapture and related teachings seem like old-time religion. So by the turn of the century, by the turn of the 20th century, dispensationalism, or what I would call proto-dispensationalism, the system had not been systematized yet, but it was out there, really was in some ways the backbone of white American evangelicalism. And so you can think about that through the growth of the Bible Institutes as this key educational innovation, this new type of institution that became the backbone of missionary and pastor training. You can think of the mission agencies that came, the sort of non-denominational mission agencies that came to dominate the global missions movement at the time. Most of those were founded by proto-dispensationalists. And then you can think of the Bible conference circuits that sort of webbed all of the United States. And we don't really have those in the same way anymore, but this was one of the main ways that evangelicals would gather together and learn about the Bible and commune with each other was through these Bible conferences. And the most famous one being the Niagara Bible Conference that took place for about 25 years at the end of the 19th century. But these were also dominated by dispensationalists. So, you know, by the time we get to 1900 or so, we're at the cusp of the growth of the fundamentalist movement, which is the next phase of the story. But at that point, dispensationalists are really important to the story of American evangelicalism, where even two or three generations before that, they weren't on the scene at all. And most of their teachings were not on the scene either, or if they were in very minority, sort of marginalized groups. But by the end of the century, they're at the center of institutional and, you could say, religious influence in the evangelical movement.
I think when a lot of people hear the word dispensationalist, they immediately gravitate towards, you know, Left Behind series, Tim LaHaye, Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth, all of that. And I know that we'll get there. I know that you get there in your book. But I think we'd probably be surprised to kind of think that think about how this theology or this kind of movement, you know, has not a whole lot of history, you know, in terms of the kind of grand scheme of the church, but that, you know, it's in the 1800s, it's before the Civil War, and you know, in your book, you kind of trace how that develops from John Ansel Darby through the Brethren, through other key leaders, kind of hitting on several kind of key moments within American history. I wondered if you could just explain, you know, what was the scene like a little bit before Darby? How does Darby change it? And then how is it affected through kind of key historical moments in the 19th and early 20th century?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good way to frame it. I mean, the first thing to say is if you talk to dispensationalists themselves, they will, of course, insist that what they're doing is not a 19th century innovation, that it goes all the way back to the New Testament, but that they can find a tradition up till today that goes all the way back. I'd obviously dissent from that view, but it's interesting. There's a book that came out right around when mine did called Discovering Dispensationalism that made this case. It was by a number of dispensationalist authors. And, you know, they assembled an interesting group of people. A couple of them, I believe, weren't even dispensationalists, so they're not only drawing from their own ranks. But they did make this claim that that they could go all the way back to the church fathers and find dispensational thought. So they didn't want to get to the systematization of it. And, you know, as a historian, I find that to be a problematic way to construct this. I mean, if you want to go hunting into the past for something that's familiar to a teaching today, there's enough church history that you'll find somebody who thought of, certainly, you know, more established doctrines like premillennialism go back to certain church fathers. Even a special role for the nation of Israel, you can find different fringe monks, maybe not so fringe, depending on who you talk to, but, you know, you can find people. But if you're really looking for a mix that resembles modern day dispensationalism, or what even dispensationalist theologians would distinguish as sort of the modern theological system, then you're going to the 19th century, and you're going to Darby, you're going to Edward Irving, who's a sort of affiliate of Darby's in Great Britain, who's also talking about end time stuff in the 1820s and 1830s. This is one of the sort of post-Napoleon era in European Protestant history is an era of a lot of apocalyptic speculation. And so that's one of the origins of a lot of these ideas is they're coming out of a seemingly very prophetically significant period of the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars. And there's a lot of Christians looking to make sense of those things in some kind of cosmic way. And I think that, you know, the U.S. is a little separated from those stories in the sense that it's a continent away. But certainly the Anglo-American networks are very active, and there's a lot of influence there. And Darby, you know, so Darby's certainly existing in that world. He's attending something called prophetic house parties. They sound pretty fun, but it was a sort of innovative way where particularly elite British actors would gather together theologians and pseudo theologians, you could say, to talk about these things. And they became sort of hotbeds of writing and speculation about how the things happening in the world were related to the second coming. So Darby's a big part of that. And what's interesting is once he gets to the U.S. or once his ideas get to the U.S., they enter in a totally different context than the original context as well. And we can probably get to that next. But I see Brandon's got something he wants to say.
Oh, just one of those things I've heard, and I now am like thinking, is this just the polemical like takedown of dispensationalism, and it just has no bearing in reality? But I just remember hearing at some point that Darby comes up with dispensationalism because he hears a like vision or kind of an ecstatic experience from some woman at a party or something. And you just mentioned prophetic house parties or something. I don't know, whatever. Does that have some bearing in reality, or is that just the polemics of again, or is there something to it?
Yeah, I would say that's largely a polemical argument that doesn't have a ton of basis in fact. The question is, and you can see how this might be an appealing polemic to engage against if you're anti-dispensationalist. But the idea is that Darby didn't actually come up with his core ideas, that he was basically plagiarizing a young girl who was having visions. I forget her name at the moment, but
Margaret MacDonald.
Margaret MacDonald. Thank you. May she never be forgotten. She's got a long afterlife. I don't think she could have imagined. But Margaret MacDonald's visions. And I almost don't even care as a historian. I mean, I don't think there's much evidence to this. So that's in one sense, I don't think there's not a lot of substantiated evidence that that's where he came up with his ideas. In fact, there's definite texts where he's speculating about some of the stuff that predates when he supposedly encountered her. Maybe she helped him or not. But often this is a polemic used to try to delegitimize dispensationalism and say, well, it's just the ravings of sort of people who have no idea what they're talking about. I don't, you know, that to me, I'm not in the confessional battle on this stuff. So, you know, the truth or falsity of it doesn't necessarily for me ride on where it came from. There's other ways to evaluate that. But I think it's undeniable that even if Darby did get those ideas, there was a lot from Margaret MacDonald. There was a lot more that had to be done for them to be developed in the way that they were developed. He starts talking about the rapture as a doctrine, just to take one example, in 1828. The full sort of significance of that doctrine and the way it fits into the broader system, that takes about 15 more years for him to work out in a number of writings to where it's the form that really makes a lot more sense to a reader today. So there's still a lot of work. There's a lot of contribution he made, even if that's the case. But I do have a footnote, at least, in the book that says I don't really find that a compelling critique. And there's a number of historians who've actually done more work than I have on that and haven't found anything to substantiate that. It really comes out of like a much later critique. In fact, it's like a post-war critique of dispensationalism where you start seeing that whole story be circulated. And that to me is also a somewhat suspicious that story doesn't emerge until 100 years after it supposedly happened as an actual accurate story.
We've talked a bit about the apocalyptic settings right around the time Darby's thinking and how that's influenced him. I wonder if we could pick up on you talking about the hermeneutical approach that he takes, and kind of a similar question. What's kind of happening around that time? Where do you think that impulse for this literalistic reading is coming from? Because it's had a huge impact ever since. But kind of what's going on before that? Where do you think that's started?
Yeah, and an interesting part of that story, which just complicates it maybe annoyingly, but Darby himself wasn't a literalist in the same way. He took prophecy literally, you could say. So he was looking for a historical, chronological material fulfillment of prophecy, which made him a literalist when it came to prophecy passages. But Darby was someone who really was into typologies of all parts of the Bible, and was totally willing to read spiritualized or allegoricalized interpretations of biblical texts. And so, this is actually one of the enduring problems of dispensationalism is that the literal hermeneutic emerges over time and is sort of grafted back over a reading that originally was not derived necessarily from a strict literalist interpretation. And this is something that later theologians in the 20th century really have to deal with. They have to understand, okay, how do we actually ground our teachings in a literalist hermeneutic so that we're not reliant on this Darbyite brethren hermeneutic, which has typologies all over the place. And even the American story has part of this. So the famous Scofield Bible, which comes out in 1909, which is edited by Cyrus Scofield, a very key proto-dispensationalist, there are over 800 typologies in Scofield's reference notes. Most of them are around typologies of Christ, but types and anti-types, all that kind of language is in there, which later more literalist theologians do not like. Like, this is the stuff that is sort of loose and you can read into it and you can liberalize your theology if you have all these typologies. And so later people like Charles Ryrie, who's a Dallas Seminary professor in the 1960s, who's very important to the story, have to go back and sort of basically not rewrite history, but sort of resituate or reroot the teachings in a literalist hermeneutic. Now, that hermeneutic has popularity in the U.S. even going back to the 19th century, largely because Americans love common sense, Scottish common sense philosophy, among other things, as Mark Knoll and others have showed us. They love the sense that what they're reading has entire, like, easily graspable meaning that any Christian can pick up and grasp immediately. The perspicuity of Scripture, maybe an extreme version of that. And so that's a pretty egalitarian, democratic way of approaching the Bible. I look at the growth of some of the technologies, you could say, of reading in the late 19th century that are emerging, the concordances, the indexes to the Bible that allow the common Christian to suddenly link together references to Israel in a way that would have taken hundreds of hours by yourself if you were just sort of reading through and doing this. And now you can do it, you know, really quickly, and you can develop new word chains and new ways to make sense of the Bible. And a more literalistic reading tends to be what less educated Christians want. They don't want something that's diving into the Greek and the Hebrew, that's diving into typologies and, you know, the fourfold meaning of Scripture and all the stuff that would be from church history. They're looking for something that's easy and accessible and seemingly more authentic, like seemingly more grounded in common sense. And so this is something, a common example of this in dispensationalism is the mantra, whenever the Bible mentions Israel, it means Israel. Right. They're on the high ground there. Right. Because then if you contradict that, it sounds like you're sort of being too sophisticated or sort of too fancy for your own good. And that comes out of a sense of a common sense reading that basically any reference of Israel in the Bible is meaning the same thing, that genre isn't really important to how we define these things, that historical development isn't important to how we define these things. And that feels very good to Americans, even in the 19th century, who are looking for sort of a way to make sense of the world and a way to read their Bibles that sort of locks everything in a certain meaning. So Darby's teachings, ironically, in some ways, grab hold among these types of lay Protestants in the U.S. that aren't really interested in this sophisticated, over-sophisticated way Darby is reading the text. And actually, one of the things I wanted to do in the book is make sure that Darby doesn't get too much airtime. So Darby's important. He's the originator of a lot of these ideas, but he's really not a good popularizer. He didn't like speaking in front of large crowds. His writing isn't very accessible. He loved doing one-on-one discipleship with pastors. He thought that was how you would build a movement. He had people around him, though, who liked his ideas and were much better at popularizing those ideas. And those were the people who developed things like the prophecy charts and other ways to sort of depict dispensationalist teachings that were what really grabbed onto American audiences. And so there's a sort of removal from the originator that also helps explain how something that was derived from a very, you could say, esoteric way of reading the Bible became something that was more seen as a lay, accessible, or common sense way of reading the Bible.
So I've recently been teaching a class at my church, an adult Sunday school class called Reading Revelation in an Election Year. And, you know, like one of my contentions is that a lot of political ideas amongst Christians flow downstream from their eschatology. And I'm trying to upend the notion that, you know, eschatology is impractical and, you know, how sometimes people talk about eschatology as kind of something that doesn't matter. God's going to take care of it. Don't worry about it. Just, you know, let's worry about salvation. Let's worry about, you know, just being good Christians or something like that. Right. And, you know, one of the things that, of course, I brought up when I talked about how we think about Israel politically is, you know, some of these ideas that we don't realize are attached to very specific dispensational ways of thinking that don't really even emerge until the 19th century, right? And then develop from there. And as I was teaching, somebody brought up the work of people like Lee Brainerd and these dispensational people who try to say, take a look at, you know, Irenaeus or Eusebius or Ephrem, and actually you can find pre-trib ideas in their writings, which of course I think is preposterous from the outset. You know, this is after looking at 1 Thessalonians 4 and 5 and especially chapter 4 and being like, hey, where's reference to Israel? Where's the logic of, you know, the way that the rapture is typically spoken of? But nevertheless, right, people look for it and find it. And you were talking about this a little bit earlier, but can you say something about this idea, especially as, you know, certain people propose that you can find, for example, pre-tribulational, you know, references in our church fathers, specifically pre-trib?
I mean, I can say, as a historian, I can say this has been a claim by dispensationalists going all the way back to when this was a, you know, when the novelty or not of their theology was at stake. I mean, I've looked into some of these. I have a few actually quotes in the book of one is Augustine, which is a really bad use of an Augustine quote about using dispensations sort of distinguishing the times. Really bad use. It's actually in the original Scofield preface. Scofield cites this as sort of a legitimating quote. He ends up removing it later because there's so much, even within that world, there's so much pushback of like, this is not using Augustine properly. I remember doing a good amount of sleuth work on a certain, this isn't a church father, but Isaac Newton had this quote about how, you know, and Isaac Newton was very into prophecy and wrote more on that topic than he did on calculus and all that kind of stuff. But he had a quote or a supposed quote that something like in the future, something like men will prophesy before the end times or something. And it's a totally specious quote, but it took me a long time because you go back and now you can use Google Books and sort of see where these quotes come from. And it goes back all the way to the 19th century. It wasn't even a dispensationalist quote. It was by some Methodist that I guess got it from somewhere probably. But I ended up actually contacting an Isaac Newton scholar who thankfully they've like digitized most of Isaac Newton's writings now. So it's much easier to sort of comb everything and be a little more certain that so-and-so, you know, didn't, or Isaac Newton didn't say this or did say it. Anyway, that was another one where it turns out Newton never said that. That is sort of, but once it takes on a life of its own, you know, later writers don't do their due diligence on the footnotes or other things. I'll say this has been a common argument by dispensationalists. There's a looser way they make it. I remember a book from the 50s tried to do this. And basically, this is the baseline argument is that dispensationalism, as the term itself implies, is about distinguishing periods of time in the Bible and God's working in different ways. And so this would be a dispensationalist way of talking. They'd say, well, there's an Old and a New Testament. There's already two dispensations there. And so really everybody's a dispensationalist or most people are dispensationalists. Unless you're some, you know, Marcionite type heretic, you think there's multiple dispensations. And that's a way they make a claim to have a deep rooted orthodoxy in their theology, that really they're doing nothing unique here. Now, if you actually read the theology, the dispensationalists do more than just distinguish time like that, because the church and Israel have different roles to play. the dispensations have a particular arc to them. They always end in failure. All that kind of stuff makes it much harder to make that claim. But that's a way that they would try to root their theology in something much older than the 19th century by saying anyone who distinguishes, you know, John Calvin's a dispensationalist, Martin Luther's a dispensationalist, because they make these distinctions as well. That's, of course, to me, preposterous. Did you use that word? Preposterous. And there's other people. Joachim of Fiore is a common medieval figure who has three eras aligned with the Trinity, and the future era is the era of the Spirit, and it's pretty apocalyptic. Now, that's fine, and that looks a little like dispensationalism. But Joachim Fiore was a Catholic monk. Like, there were so many other parts of his theology that had no dispensationalist would ever subscribe to: ecclesiology, view of Mary, view of the saints, all that kind of stuff. And so you can sort of isolate that part of someone in the Middle Ages and say, okay, that looks a little, I guess, if you squint, like a dispensationalist view on something. But then if you zoom out at all, you realize, oh, that's isolating one part of a really broad theology that is nothing like dispensationalism as we currently understand it today. And that's where it gets really hard to root it, even root dispensationalism in the Reformation era, let alone go all the way back to church history. Because the church fathers, sure, some of them were premillennialists, you could say. They were expecting Jesus to come back to establish the kingdom. But they were doing so with a much different context in mind, and none of the sort of background Israel literal hermeneutic stuff that dispensationalists would say for them is, you know, essential to the way they read the Bible. So I'm pretty skeptical of most of that stuff, but I also want to recognize that I've talked to enough of them. They're good faith, are they good faith arguments? They're arguments they really believe. They're not necessarily just deploying them cynically. They really believe them. And so there is a little more care to be taken to engage than just sort of treating them like they are, you know, totally vacuous intellectually, because people are really basing, even in, you know, church settings, are basing the authority of this theology on these types of claims.
Yeah, I've described it as they're earnest. They're definitely earnest, and you know, there's no doubt about their Christian faith and these sorts of things and all of that. I will say I do think there's doubt about their scholarship in the sense that I find it to be bankrupt. You know, in your recent Gospel Coalition piece, you talk about this distinction between pop dispensationalism and academic dispensationalism. And I was actually thinking about this in relation to this type of quote unquote scholarship, where self-publications about, you know, how the pre-trib can be found in church fathers. Their mode of presentation is scholarly dispensationalism or academic dispensationalism. But I just wonder if there needs to be another category, or should we just say, yes, they're on the scholarly side, or actually are they in a way, because they, you know, a lot of these people don't have academic positions, they don't have earned degrees in biblical studies. Is it right to say they're part of academic dispensationalism? I mean, somebody like John Walvoord or Ryrie, like you're saying, obviously we'll put them on that side of that divide. But I don't know, some of this stuff, when you go down like the YouTube rabbit hole of, you know, dispensationalism, you find a lot of presenting scholarly dispensationalism, but I'm wondering if that's appropriate.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction. I would say that there remains an actual academic conversation. It's small. It may be bigger than I thought it was when I finished writing the book. Some of them have come and, you know, talked to me, but it's very small. It's very marginal. I think two of the places that you do have to reckon with are Dallas Theological Seminary, which still has a good number of, you know, card-carrying dispensationalist scholars on its rolls, and then Liberty University's Divinity School, which requires pretty much you signing a dispensationalist statement of faith to be on there. And, you know, you look at those people, they have good degrees, many of them do, and they publish in places that aren't entirely just for dispensationalists. So I want to say there's space for those people. And I also want to say that, you know, a lot of people might hold these views but do work that doesn't necessarily impinge or draw on those views. You could be a New Testament scholar, maybe. You could be an Old Testament scholar. These would come through, you know, dispensationalist commitments would come through in some ways, but you could also do other things where those wouldn't really come through, and you could do entirely entirely, I was going to say unremarkable scholarship, but that doesn't sound very good. You could do scholarship that is no different than someone who is not a dispensationalist. I do think there is a problematic tradition of, you could say, pseudo academic dispensationalism that, unfortunately, from my view, the actual academics have been far too accommodating to, and in fact tried to leverage when it was advantageous to them. And I would definitely put the people you mentioned, John Walver, Charles Ryrie, these are people who were very authoritative in theological circles in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. They also tried to go pop and publish books like Oil, Armageddon, and the Middle East. That's John Walver's book from 1974, right after the Yom Kippur War in 1973. And, you know, he did that to try to capitalize on the popular eschatology interest of the time. Charles Ryrie did that also in the late 70s. He published a book about newspaper and Bible or something where you're supposed to read the news through dispensationalist categories. And there's a plenty of other examples. I remember during the first Gulf War, is it John Dyer? I don't want to misname the first name, but a Dallas Seminary professor, Charles Dyer. There we go. Oh, is that the same one? There are so many of them. I don't even know if those are the right ones.
I have them all. They're great. Charles Dyer. We got Beyond Iraq by Michael Evans. It's great. Great.
Yeah. There was Love one it. That has Saddam Hussein's face on it very prominently.
And it's the first edition.
The Rise of Babylon. That's what the book is called.
Mm, yes.
It's John Dyer. It can't be John Dyer. John Dyer is a current professor at Dallas Seminary who does like tech and stuff. So Charles Dyer must be the person. But, you know, that was very opportunistic. That came out in 1990, obviously trying to associate the first Gulf War with end times prophecy. So that's really where there's a problem to me as a sort of looking out as a Christian who's a historian, but also sort of critiquing some of this stuff, is that pseudo academic lane that is occupied by sort of kooks that today would be on YouTube. Back in the 80s, there was the 88 reasons why the rapture will happen in 1988, those types of people. Who look sort of academic until you start reading it and you realize it's very much esoteric and sui generis of the author. But unfortunately, there hasn't been that distinction over time. And I get it in a way. Like, I get why the academics would want to capitalize on the popular. I think we all, in any field, you have that draw to some extent, which is like, I wish more people read my stuff. How do I sort of translate my stuff into a way that more people can read? I think this is a pretty problematic way of doing it, however. And it's really over time, this has been part of my book's called The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism. The fall part, in part, has been seeing the academic citadels of dispensationalism, such as they were 50 years ago, really muddy themselves with this more popular type stuff, and really make it hard for a lot of people to distinguish between the pop and the scholarly, and at the same time, the scholarly being pretty strongly critiqued by academics as well, makes for a pretty tough story for the last 50 years. But maybe you're right. Maybe there should be a pseudo academic lane, but having the two gives me a little starker contrast to really draw the distinction as well.
I think it's interesting coming on to the idea of the fall, because you've talked about the fall of the scholarly dispensationalism, and I absolutely agree with you, seeing the institutions change and shrink. It doesn't seem to me like there's a fall in the pop dispensationalism, and I think I really like your subtitle of how the evangelical battle over the end time shaped a nation. I think you've written the book I wanted to write next, having spent so much time in First and Second Thessalonians, because you sit with something like Second Thessalonians, we've got the man of lawlessness and the restrainer and these shadowy figures, and you've got Augustine saying, I have no idea what Paul's talking about here. And rather than taking that as a clue, you can see how people are trying to map that onto what's happening today. And so I think I'd love to hear what you think of that, about the pop dispensationalism, and hear more about how that has shaped U.S. politics and kind of U.S. culture.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe I was trying to be too cute with fall in the pop side, but I do think it's a really a degradation in quality. That's one way I've tried to articulate it, which is what pop dispensationalism's legacy today is largely in a commercial and political stream, each of those. So on the commercial side, pop dispensationalism becomes, you know, very popular through the Left Behind novels, through televangelism. I look a little at CCM, where it comes and goes. And in the broader sort of fiction, apocalyptic fiction genre, dispensationalism in the sort of beats of the dispensational scenario become well known beyond just evangelicals. They become sort of part of the background of American apocalypticism in general. So I don't find that to be the most enriching way to engage theology. In fact, it really short circuits deep thought about theology, because there's this sort of schema, and then you're just sort of fitting in things in the newspaper the world into that schema. Though, I think a lot of Christians reason about global politics and geopolitics in general through that lens. And so that's one way I think that that's going to be with us. I never meant to imply that that was fall does not mean disappearance or anything like that. It's just a collapse, and there's a big pile of rubble and ruins, and you got to deal with it. And then on the other side, of course, is politics, which is a really interesting one and a complicated story. Dispensationalists have been involved in politics going all the way back to the early 20th century. That's one of those myths that many historians have tried to push back against, the idea that until 1979 or until abortion, fundamentalists didn't care about politics. They cared the whole time, though they engaged in different ways. I look in the 1920s how many dispensationalists were involved in anti-evolution movements and other things. But there is a story about the 1970s and about the prominence of dispensationalist pastors and writers at the forefront of forming the Christian right. And so here we have people like Jerry Falwell and Tim LaHaye and Pat Robertson. Robertson's a little heterodox in his embrace of dispensationalism, but most of it's there. He talks about the rapture a lot. And so there's this moment in the 80s where dispensationalists are basically at the head of the Christian right, and they're shaping a lot of the rhetoric and the theology that is implicit in the way the religious, the Christian right is acting. And I really try to focus in on how they're using dispensational theology to frame the political movement. And yet, if you fast forward a few decades, dispensationalists today are less prominent. They're still around. There's plenty of active dispensationalist pastors and political actors, but they have been it's diversified a bit, and there are now a much broader array of evangelical political actors. Many of them come out of Pentecostal traditions that may have some dispensationalist influences, but often are more in the dominionist, Seven Mountains type theology. And then there's also this interesting reemergence of post-millennial theology as well, that actually goes back to the 70s and 80s. And that was one of the things I trace in the end of the book, is some of the harshest critics of Jerry Falwell and that group were the post-millennialists, the reform post-millennialists, the Gary Norths of the world, the Rush Dooneys of the world, who looked at dispensationalist political activism and said, this isn't going to last. Like, the framing of why evangelicals should get involved in politics by dispensationalists was not, there wasn't an eschatology that really drove them to it. I mean, they had a defensive posture. They wanted to combat secularism. They wanted to have more evangelization before the rapture, all that kind of stuff. But over decades, is that going to sustain a movement, a political movement? And of course, they were offering their own post-millennial vision of establishing a Christian kingdom, a Christian nation, as a much more sustainable one. And here we are a few decades later, and you see some of that bearing fruit. Not that I want to give Gary North too much credit, but he had something there where he was critiquing the way that dispensationalists engaged with politics as something that came and went, depending on exactly what the situation was. And so that's another way where that's a big legacy of dispensationalism, is it's still in our politics. I think after October of last year and the Israel-Hamas war, we saw a lot of that right away. You saw a lot of pastors weighing in. And unfortunately, you see the sort of the crudeness of the way that was often invoked, which is pastors claiming authority because their version, their interpretation of the Bible fits with what's happening, and then speculation that has already been proven wrong about sort of how the war is going to develop, that is supposed to lend authority to these pastors because they have some special insight or their reading of the Bible has some special insight. I find that to be a pretty depressing fall, you could say, of a way that Christians engage politics as well. So that's how I meant it. I do not think we're ever, I don't know if ever is a, maybe that's too strong. I don't think anytime soon we're going to get rid of dispensationalist influence in our politics or in our pop culture, our evangelical pop culture. I think they're here for quite a long time, though I do think there's pretty significant polling data that shows that younger evangelicals are very disconnected from a lot of this culture and the politics as well. But there was just a study that came out last month by a couple Israelis who are studying the sort of Christian Zionist phenomenon, which is related. But their polling, which was pretty in depth, showed that 68% of evangelicals under 40 are not premillennialist. So they're either post or amillennialist, or they don't want to define themselves. That is pretty dramatic. If we're down to basically a third of young evangelicals being premillennialist, that's going to have a massive change, say 15, 20 years from now, about the appeal of something like dispensationalism, which presumes premillennialism. So I do think things will change, but I also think the dispensationalism has been very successful on the popular front, both in the commercial and the political spheres.
I wondered if you might want to backtrack just a little bit, and you know, because you talk about in the first part of your book about, you know, the rise of dispensationalism with Darby and others, the followers. You know, you talk about kind of the influence of technology, of concordances and maps and diagrams and all this stuff. And then obviously a lot of us, well, not obviously, but a lot of us are much more familiar with the later stage of dispensationalism. But I feel like many people just have a blank space when it comes to, you know, early 20th century, and just even thinking about like all the things that are happening in the world, right? World War One, World War Two, you know, mm-hmm. even leading up to, you know, kind of Cold War, Vietnam, like all of that happens before the moral majority kind of kicks off, and you know, pop dispensationalism comes to the forefront of our kind of understanding. I wonder if you could just fill our listeners in of just what's happening in that time. How has it gone from a little Irish immigrant preacher to what we see and are more familiar with today?
Yeah, that's great. This is actually my favorite part of the book. The one I enjoyed the most was, say, I think it's part two, 1900 to 1960, sort of that period. And, you know, earlier on, I talked about how around the turn of the century, dispensationalism was very core to what it meant to be, to sort of the evangelical movement at the time. Not all evangelicals were dispensationalists, but a lot of the leading ones were, and a lot of the institutions were. And, you know, the next era is the era of World War One, and then the fundamentalist movement. And this is where you start seeing the self-identification of being a dispensationalist emerged. So the term itself does not emerge until the late 1920s. So before 1927, if someone, you know, ran up to Cyrus Schofield and said, "Hey, you're a dispensationalist," he wouldn't know what exactly you're talking about. I think he could probably guess, you know, some of the things you're saying, but the ism, the sort of systematization of these things into a concrete system and tradition that then is handed down, was something that came about during the modernist fundamentalist movements in the 1920s and 30s. And particularly, dispensationalists all landed on the fundamentalist side, more or less. They were conservative in their theology, but they were not the only people who were fundamentalists. There was also a big chunk of, you could say, more denominational, reformed fundamentalists, particularly out of the Baptist and Presbyterian denominations. And dispensationalists tended to come out of the more revivalist, interdenominational world. And these seem like pretty small differentiations when we're talking about all of American Protestantism. But once you shove all these people into a fundamentalist movement together, they start drawing sharp distinctions between themselves and actually start blaming each other for why they're in this situation in the first place. And that's where the term itself comes out of, is a Presbyterian Reformed fundamentalist named Philip Morrow, who was at one point a fan of Cyrus Schofield and everything else, but that was decades before. He starts blaming dispensationalists, and he comes up with the term, and he says this is a modern heresy that has infected part of the fundamentalist world. And his particular complaint was that dispensationalists don't care about political activism and fighting for denominations. They're just waiting for the rapture and doing missions work. And he thought that was insufficient. And so the term comes out in this sort of intra-fundamentalist debate between dispensationalists and their opponents. Well, this emerges in the 30s and 40s and 50s into probably the most important yet least talked about, at least from my sort of American religious hat, a distinction within the evangelical world, which is between dispensational and covenantal theology. And this is something that shapes churches, shapes seminaries, shapes all of the publications, the presses. Many of them have to take a side. Are you a dispensationalist press or seminary, or are you a Reformed covenantal press or seminary? And the key institutions that come out of this on the seminary level are Dallas Seminary, which becomes the dispensationalist seminary. And then at that time, it was Westminster Seminary, which was the covenantalist seminary. And, you know, both of them grew as fast as they could, competing with each other for the mantle of fundamentalism, and both tried to ally with the different parts of the broader fundamentalist world that were seen as sort of on their side on certain key issues. And that is the competition that really gives us a lot of mid-20th century evangelicalism. It's the building of the institutions around these two camps, and then the movements of critique and reform within those two camps. And so you can read, this is how I read, like, neo-evangelicalism, the Billy Graham, Carl Henry, Fuller Seminary, Christianity Today type evangelicalism, is a strong reaction to dispensationalism. And they actually, if you know where to look, they say this. They particularly find dispensationalist views of the kingdom really insufficient for any type of cultural engagement. And so that's where they go with their critiques in the 1940s and 50s. And then you can sort of continue the story forward and see how the dispensationalist covenantalist divide really starts shaping the way that different parts of the evangelical world respond to the Cold War, respond to the 60s and all the cultural upheavals in that period as well. So that's what's happening in this period. I really wanted to capture the golden age, you could say, of dispensationalist scholarship in the 1950s and 60s. This is when Walvoord and Ryrie and Dwight Pentecost and Charles Feinberg and others were at Dallas Seminary. They founded Talbot Seminary right in this time. This is 1950. Grace Theological Seminary in Winona Lake, Indiana. So there's three seminaries in three parts of the country training hundreds of students. And it really seemed like you could have, this would be like, you know, around 1960, you could really predict, you wouldn't be crazy to predict, wow, dispensationalism is going to be like a major part of academic evangelical discussions for the next 50 years. How could it not be? It's got these massive institutions, it's got journals, it's got presses. And then, of course, the story is much different. And even within two decades of that period, even by 1980, the academic story is one of massive retreat by dispensationalists. And by the 80s and 90s, you have the emergence of progressive dispensationalism, and you have all types of sort of, you know, sort of dissenter movements on the academic level. And I really wanted to capture that because I thought for a lot of historians who look at evangelicalism from the outside, they blur together the cultural and the theological stories, and they really don't see a distinction. And I really love Paul Boyer's book from the 90s called When Time Shall Be No More. Chair is my advisor's chair here at University of Wisconsin, so I feel like there's some type of kinship there. But he did this in his book, which was sort of the book for about 20 years on this topic. But he would quote within the same paragraph, you know, Hal Lindsey and John Walvoord and Charles Ryrie, and he wouldn't really make distinctions on what are they trying to do with what they're saying and where are they situated institutionally and intellectually, you could say. So that's something I wanted to bring about. And really in this middle period of 1900 and 1960, you really get a sense of how there was at least an attempt for a scholastic or scholarly dispensationalist movement that ultimately falls apart, I would argue, but really had an important effect on the broader intellectual terrain of evangelicalism in the 20th century.
I think the question I have is what next in the sense of engaging with the pop dispensationalism and helping people think more deeply or meet more theologically, getting past that sort of, because I find this even on this side of the Atlantic, like you get that rapture theology or certain interpretations of Israel, especially after this year, is just still rife, even if no one's ever actually been formally taught that in their institutions or anything, but it's just all over the place. And so how do we engage with that? Well, what would you suggest what's a good starting point, at least.
Yeah, boy, I don't have really good answers here, but I do end the book talking about two people I've enjoyed, though I don't endorse everything they write, but N.T. Wright and Richard Middleton, who both have written on eschatology, on a different way of thinking about eschatology, from a pretty conservative evangelical perspective, all things considered. And I think what I liked about their work is that they're not doing what so many of these covenantalist reformed type critics did in the mid 20th century, which was try to basically say we shouldn't talk about eschatology. Like it's not a key part of theology, or it's sort of an embarrassing part. I think that's not going to really satisfy Christians, certainly Christians who've been already formed in a way to be thinking eschatologically. I think just saying, just don't think that way, or, so suppress the desire to want to know what's going to happen next. I mean, some of that you should, the sort of date setting and detail stuff, but the sense that, the Christian faith is a story and we're in the middle of the story and there's a really hopeful ending to the story, I think that's all really good. And I think Wright and Middleton really play into that. So, I mean, that would be the start, is to sort of affirm the eschatological thrust of the Christian faith. But then to, sort of get into a way of, posturing yourself toward eschatology that is much more removed from day-to-day news, and maybe on the reverse side, much more engaged in the first century context, in the languages that, Daniel or Revelation are written in. And, if Christians did that, they'd be well down the road to rethinking some of these tried and true pop dispensationalist ways of thinking. I'm not too hopeful that that's going to happen. And partly that this is where my, I don't know if it's pessimism or just realism comes in, but the modern American church, I'll say, I don't know as much about the British scene, but the modern American evangelical church is formed so much by mass media now, and now internet media, far more than, I don't think I'm crazy to guess that far more Christians are watching YouTube videos about the end times than reading any piece of scholarship or even just accessible lay theology on the end times. And that's a problem. And I don't know exactly how to combat that on the large scale until practices change. And I don't know how practices change unless a lot of other things change in our society. I think some of this is just realizing what you can do in your local context and, working hard there. None of us are going to change the media habits of Americans anytime soon, or the offerings on display, both on TV and on the internet. But I am a little, I am more than a little pessimistic on sort of some massive shift because of that. Even the polling I cited about younger evangelicals who seem to be much more on some other theological terrain than dispensationalism, that doesn't necessarily mean it's all good either. I think there's other things influencing younger evangelical theology that can be just as problematic as dispensationalism has been in the past. So it's not just moving away from dispensationalism, I would say. It's also, what are we moving toward? And is what we're moving toward, more accurate to the extent we can understand accuracy from a scholarly perspective, and more going to contribute to positive discipleship for Christians in the pews? And there I'm much more hopeful on the local and relational level than I am on any type of mass level, though I will give a plug. I really like the Bible Project. They embody a lot of this theology, and I go to a church that Tim Mackey pastored back now 10, 15 years ago, before the Bible Project was even on the map. So I got to learn from Tim Mackey. This was actually when I was doing my PhD research in history, when he was sort of testing out these ideas, his first 5-minute videos and stuff like that. And I came to be really thankful I came across him when I did, because it helped me understand how I could, I guess you could say, deconstruct or move beyond a dispensationalist way of thinking about a lot of things without feeling like I was becoming less of a Christian or somehow forsaking my heritage or something like that. And so there are more accessible things out there like the Bible Project, but I also realize that the Bible Project is a drop in the bucket compared to the media market that's out there as well.
So we all need to just get on eschatology TikTok next. That's the way to reach the.
Yeah, see that
we literally have a podcast. I feel like.
Yeah, that's true. I worry about like a TikTok. Yeah, I mean, this is where like the Jacques Ellul, Marshall McLuhan. It's just like I don't know if there's a way to redeem that stuff. I also think there probably is because plenty of good people are on there, I'm sure, doing stuff. But I'm certainly not the one to pioneer that one because it does feel like the medium does really dictate a lot of what you can do in these places. I certainly believe that. I remember I quote in the book Neil Postman on televangelism and how just the medium itself is about entertainment. Like it just can't, you can't do spiritual formation in the same way on television that you can do in person. And I really do think that's true. And so there is always a hesitancy to pick up the newest technology because I worry like, what are the things you just can't avoid by engaging in this technology? And I unfortunately think TikTok is right at the top of the list for me right now of the problematic ones.
Oh man. Yeah. The medium is the message. Yeah. That's really important to keep in mind. And wow, we could talk about this for ages, but really appreciate this conversation on the history of dispensationalism. Thank you so much for sharing with us. And we hope listeners will check out your book, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, published by Ehrman. So thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Helm.
It's been a pleasure.